My name is Douglas Coots. I teach in the chemistry department, and I'm faculty advisor to Moccasin Christian Fellowship. It's my pleasure this evening to welcome you to this 8th annual C.S. Lewis Lecture. The C.S. Lewis Lectureship was established in Chattanooga to perpetuate the Christian and literary legacy of Clive Staple Lewis, an Oxford intellectual with a strong commitment to Jesus Christ. Lewis had a superb gift for communicating Christianity to his world. The lecturers in this series are chosen for their ability to communicate the message of Christ in the tradition of Lewis. It is also my privilege to present the person who will introduce our speaker tonight. Dr. Charles Hummel makes his home in Massachusetts and visits Chattanooga 3 or 4 times a year in his capacity as Director of Faculty Ministries for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Charles Hummel is responsible in large measure for the establishment of the C.S. Lewis Lecture Series on this campus. Charles is eminently qualified to make tonight's introduction. He shares many interests with the speaker. Among other things, Dr. Hummel has written a book about the life of Galileo. May I kindly present Dr. Charles Hummel.
Almost 450 years ago, an obscure Polish astronomer published a book which revolutionized not only astronomy, but the whole scientific enterprise. Nicholas Copernicus was, first of all, a conscientious church administrator all of his life. That was his profession. He did his astronomy evenings and weekends. And his book, published in 1543, concerning the revolutions of the heavenly spheres, was dedicated to Pope Paul III. Actually, it was published the year of Copernicus's death. 60 years later, Johannes Kepler, a father of mathematical astronomy and a very devout Lutheran Christian, carried on his researches, discovering his 3 laws of planetary motion. And he is known for commenting on his research in the form of a prayer, O God, I am thinking thy thoughts after thee. Our speaker tonight has become a leading authority on both Copernicus and Kepler. And he has followed in their footsteps to become a noted astronomer as well as a committed Christian. Dr. Owen Gingrich currently is senior astronomer of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, as well as professor of astronomy and the history of science at Harvard University. He's a prolific writer of 12 books and of more than 100 articles. An excellent teacher, as we will see again this evening. And interestingly, about 4 years ago, he won the Harvard Radcliffe Phi Beta Kappa Prize for excellence in teaching. And then I just discovered before our meeting, he and his wife are ardent collectors of rare seashells. And I don't know whether that has any connection with astronomy or not, but it shows an interest in his hobby. Tonight we are here to hear Dr. Gingrich. Our topic, as advertised, is Let There Be Light, Modern Cosmogony, and Biblical Creation. So, Dr. Gingrich, we welcome you here for the lecture, and he will set the agenda for the first part, and afterwards there'll be questions, as you are his class for the evening, and we'll feel quite free to ask whatever questions come to mind during that discussion session. Dr. Gingrich, we welcome you as the 8th C.S. Lewis Lecturer.
Thank you very much for that very fine and interesting introduction. Always like to hear about my favorite heroes, Copernicus and Kepler, and you'll hear a smattering about them later on this evening. Some months back, I had occasion to look at the manuscript for my lecture as I first gave it several years ago in a somewhat different form at the University of Pennsylvania. The first part of the lecture was very elegantly printed out from the word processor. Then there were those pages which I had typed on a portable typewriter in the hotel room there in Philadelphia. And finally, at the end, there were those handwritten sheets that I had managed to finish just as I was being introduced. I'm happy to say that tonight the lecture is slightly better organized than that, but because there's so much I want to say, and I want to say it as precisely as I can, I'll follow my manuscript fairly closely, and should you want to see it, it has been, in fact, in an earlier form, published in a book edited by Roland Fry, entitled Is God a Creationist? And you can find it there. The world of modern science has opened up truly remarkable vistas. In the microscopic world of the atom, there are marvels to stagger the imagination. Submicroscopic particles can annihilate antiparticles, transforming matter into a burst of energy. Or in reverse, pure energy can give birth to matter with exotic properties of charm and strangeness. At the other end of the scale, astronomers can plumb the world of the large, delineating our Milky Way as a giant pinwheel galaxy containing over 200 billion stars, about 50 for every man, woman, and child on Earth. A number which is all too familiar to us, it is roughly the annual Pentagon budget in dollars. Beyond our own solar stellar system, there are countless other galaxies scattered out to the fringes of the universe, some 10 to 20 billion light years away. Now, these are all discoveries of the 20th century. Most of them are scarcely 50 years old. And yet, none of them, I think, is quite as astonishing as the scientific scenario that has now been outlined for the first moments of creation. During the past two decades, knowledge of the world of the smallest possible size, that is, the domain of particle physics, has been combined with astronomy to describe the universe in its opening stages. Now, the physics ultimately fails as the nucleocosmologists push their calculations closer and closer back toward the beginning. They fail before they get to time zero, but they get pretty close to 10 to the minus 43rd second. At that point, at a second split so fine that no clock could measure it, the entire observable universe is compressed within the wave-like blur described by the uncertainty principle. It's so tiny and compact that it could pass through the eye of a needle. Not just this room or the Earth or the solar system, but the entire universe squeezed into a dense dot of pure energy. And then comes the explosion. There's no way to express that explosion, writes the poet Robinson Jeffers. All that exists roars into flame. The tortured fragments rush away from each other into all the sky. New universes jewel the black breast of night, and far off the outer nebulae, like charging spearmen, again invade emptiness. It's an amazing picture of pure and incredibly energetic light being transformed into matter and leaving its vestiges behind. Countless atoms and even more numerous photons of light that were generated in that mighty blast. And it's even more astonishing when we realize that the final fate of the universe, whether it will expand forever or fall back in on itself in some future big crunch, was determined in that opening moment. Furthermore, That moment has left behind a telltale imprint in the ratios of hydrogen and heavy hydrogen, or deuterium, and helium abundances, imprints that may eventually enable a nucleocosmologist to describe the end as well as the beginning of our physical universe. But, and you may well ask this, what evidence do I have that this wondrous tale is true? Or is it just some strange kind of science fiction? Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? The Lord asked Job from the whirlwind. And to be sure, none of us were there. So, I have to admit, what the scientists in my detective story have devised is an intricate reconstruction, assembled just as the detective in your whodunit thriller systematically reconstructs the crime. Now, that metaphor is not bad, for a great deal of modern science rests on conjecture, albeit rational conjecture. But I think the detective story idea is not quite adequate to convey the grandeur and the extent of modern science. So personally, I believe there's a better metaphor, and that is in likening science to a beautiful panoramic tapestry. It's beautiful in the way the contrasting patterns and themes are organized into a unified, coherent whole. It's panoramic in its scope, going from in a majestic sweep of all of nature, from the minutest subatomic particles to the vast outer reaches of space and time. But like a tapestry, it's a human artifact. It's ingeniously and seamlessly woven together. It's not easy to unravel one part of it without damaging the whole. Now, I can't, in my short compass here tonight, lay in place all of the threads of this vast tapestry whose pattern includes the first moments of creation. But I'm going to try to weave several of them into place. One part of the design concerns our knowledge of distances, and another of the time scale of the universe. And both of those are woven tightly together. The ancient Greeks already had figured out pretty well the size of the earth. And by triangulation, they got the distance to the moon pretty well. Before the end of the 17th century, that is when Isaac Newton was alive, more precise triangulation, made possible with the telescope and refined measuring scales, allowed astronomers to get distances within our planetary system. And then allowing the moving Earth, as it goes around the sun, to sweep out a longer baseline, they were able to triangulate to the nearest stars. This was a delicate feat. It was accomplished only around the middle of the last century. But those trigonometric procedures, the triangulation, have their limitations. Proxima Centauri, the first star beyond the sun, is 400 trillion kilometers away. It takes light 4 years to reach us. But the triangulation can barely penetrate 100 times farther. Not even 1% of the distance across our Milky Way. Perhaps it's better if I try to show you this by means of a slide. If we can have the first slide on, we will be able to see a typical galaxy, and someplace there we should find the slide. Somehow we've missed the first one. There it is. This is the great galaxy in Andromeda. The peppering of stars that fills the screen are foreground stars from our own Milky Way. But what I want to draw your attention to is that dusty nebulous spiral, which in turn is composed of a great number of individual stars. It's like our own Milky Way system, and the sun would be out in those distant arms, and the space within a galaxy like that that we could examine by trigonometric means would be a circle about this big up there on the screen. So it's a very tiny part of that galaxy. And if we would like, in a similar way, to examine our own Milky Way galaxy, we've got to use some other technique than just triangulation. And here's where we call on a property of light, the geometrical diminution of light with distance, well expressed by the aphorism that faintness means farness. All you've got to do is get an object that you understand, that you know to be the same from one place to the other. Once you know its absolute brightness, if then you can see its apparent brightness, the fainter it is, the farther away it is, and you can calculate its distance. Now, one of the kinds of objects, and it doesn't look as if this button works at all, so I'll have to ask you to bring me the next slide. This graph shows you the pulsations of brightness of what we call the Cepheid variable stars. You can see that it goes up and down rhythmically, changing by not quite a full magnitude. The time in days is across the bottom, so you can see that this particular pattern repeats about every 6 days. If you get a star like this with a pattern of changes of light, we can be pretty sure that it is a standard kind of physical object, and it's going to be pretty much the same wherever we find it. This relationship was worked out at Harvard College Observatory by a woman astronomer named Henrietta Leavitt around 1915. And then out at Mount Wilson Observatory in California, the next slide, there was a young astronomer named Harlow Shapley, who put that interesting piece of information to work, because he was able to get a calibration of the absolute brightness of a Cepheid variable of 6 days, and thereby was able to work out the relationship. If you have a longer period, the star is slightly brighter. A shorter period, it's slightly fainter. And knowing this, he was able to use these variable stars at tremendous distances to establish the distance of, well, the next object. The next object on the next slide will show you a typical globular star cluster. There are about 100 of these known in our own Milky Way galaxy. And a few of them have those Cepheid variable stars. And as Shapley started looking at them, what he discovered was that he could find from the faintness of the stars the farness of the globular clusters, and thus could establish that some of them were 10,000 light years away, and some 40,000, and some 60,000. And these were tremendous distances, larger than astronomers were used to. It was rather mind-boggling at the time. But there was more. The next slide shows you about 6% of the entire sky. Yet it contains 30 globular clusters, all of them circled on this image, so that you find a tremendous concentration of the globular clusters just in one direction. Knowing their distances, typically around, Shapley thought, around 50,000 light years, we know now that he didn't calibrate it exactly right. Typically the distance is 25,000 light years, but the idea is essentially the same. And now you'll see the picture that was eventually put together of our Milky Way. In the next slide you see the cross-section of this pinwheel, a great nucleus in the middle. Off there on the left-hand side, you can just see marked, maybe you can't read it, but there is a word there with a little arrow for the sun. And those heavy dots are the globular clusters. And Shapley conjectured that they were surrounding the nucleus of our Milky Way, a distant nucleus too far to be seen because of the dust veining between the sun and the nucleus, but nevertheless he could hypothesize that it should be there, and he could get the scale of our own Milky Way galaxy, a scale which then is set to be approximately 100,000 light years from one end all the way across to the other side. And I have to say that although back there around 1920, when Shapley was delineating this picture, there was no hope of seeing to the middle of the galaxy, to the nucleus, because of all the intervening dust. Nowadays, working with other techniques in other parts of the spectrum, we can, for example, with radio waves or with infrared light, actually penetrate to the nucleus and get information directly about it. The next slide will show us his colleague at Mount Wilson Observatory, because Shapley, partly as a result of this brilliant work, was offered the directorship of the Harvard College Observatory. He came to the East Coast, but staying behind at Mount Wilson Observatory, there in the mountains above Pasadena and Hollywood, was Edwin Hubble. And using the same 100-inch telescope, he discovered Cepheid variable stars in the Andromeda Galaxy, in the Andromeda Nebula, as it was then called, and subsequently it became called a galaxy when it was appreciated that it was like our own galactic system. He was able to get a distance, about 1 million light years. We know now, as part of the whole recalibration of things, that its distance is just over 2 million light years. He was then able to make good guesses as to the distances of other galaxies, especially when they were in clusters. To say guesses is perhaps a reasonable choice of words, because if you go, let's look at the next slide, to a cluster of this sort, which is now something around 100 or 200 million light years away, you can no longer see the Cepheid variables because these galaxies are much too far away. Once more, there's a peppering of stars from our own Milky Way, but the fuzzies there are the galaxies of the Coma Berenices cluster of galaxies. Well, how can you do it? In some of the clusters of galaxies that are a little bit closer, it's possible to see globular clusters around the galaxies. And if those globular clusters are like the globular clusters around our own galaxy and around the Andromeda Galaxy, then we can use those using the principle faintness means farness and can make that calculation. It's a little bit tricky in a situation like this to get a distance here because this is even too far away to see the globular clusters. So what astronomers have done is simply to assume that the clusters of galaxies contain similar objects. Now, maybe the brightest handful are almost pathological specimens. Too bright or not bright enough or something. But if you count down and say, let's take the fifth brightest galaxy in this cluster so that we eliminate those oddball or exceptional ones, then maybe the fifth brightest in each cluster would be comparable. And wonderfully, it makes a very coherent picture of the distant heavens if we do that. Everything seems to hang together in a way that is non-contradictory and convinces astronomers that they're on the right trail in setting up the distance scale that way. Doing this then has allowed astronomers to get distances now that go out to a few billion light years. Well, a common mistake for me to say million instead of billion, because when you get to these numbers, which are so fantastically beyond ordinary experience, About all we can do is set things relative to something else that's pretty big and just do the scale by stepping stones in that way. There's hardly any way that I can envision in any deeply psychological form what 3 or 4 billion years is. It's truly mind-boggling. But nevertheless, as a picture, it hangs together in a way that enables us to paint this wonderful tapestry of science. If we go out to those objects that are about 1 billion light years away, I must say they don't look like much. They're just a little fuzzy blur of on a photographic plate, or with the modern techniques, you don't even get a photograph. You get what amounts to a television picture, which is caught by electronic means because the electronic detectors are so much more efficient than blackening grains of silver on a photographic plate. But nevertheless, these objects are extraordinarily fascinating, not because of the way they appear, but because of another property which they've got. And that was first noted by a man named V.M. Slipher, who appears in the next picture. He was working at the Lowell Observatory. Oh, wait a minute. Hey, that's... Stop. Let's go to that next picture. It obviously wasn't V.M. Slipher. I just wanted you to see a little bit farther into space, about a billion light years. Most of those things are stars in the foreground, but the little peppering, I've exaggerated. It's probably more like 500 million, the little peppering of objects are these galaxies, which are beginning to look so nondescript that they're almost uninteresting there. And now V.M. Slipher should turn up on the next slide with his spectroscope. Working out at the Lowell Observatory, where they were so misguided about these things that Percival Lowell supposed in those early days that these delicate little spirals were not gigantic star systems far away, but were something close where there was a planetary system evolving. And he supposed that, since he was interested in planets, that if his astronomer Slipher would take some spectra of them, he could see something about what they were made of and understand this process. But spectra have a measurable property as to where certain features of the spectrum should appear. If they get shifted toward the red, it's a Doppler effect similar to the change in pitch that you hear when an ambulance or fire siren comes rushing past you. As I heard yesterday, a train whistle. It changes in pitch. It goes off, and the light from these objects does the same thing. If it's rushing away from us, it changes, becomes redder. And he found his great astonishment that the farther that he went, the fainter the galaxies, it seemed. Well, Slipher didn't put this together. Slipher just noticed that the speeds were colossal, way more than for ordinary stars in our Milky Way system. That if they had speeds like this, they would certainly just fly out of the Milky Way and get lost. And then it was Edwin Hubble who started setting up the scale of distances, and he then realized that the farther away the object was and the fainter, the faster it was going away. And the next slide now shows us a kind of view of the expanding universe. There you have it. It looks as if they're all rushing away from us. I should put in as a footnote that no, they're rushing away from any center that you choose. Any galaxy will show you this same picture. But the important thing is that as these galaxies rush away, you can make the calculation backwards to find out when they were all in one place. All crushed in one harbor, in the words of Robinson Jeffers. And that calculation comes out to be some 10 to 20 billion years back. That's a time that can be interpreted as the age of the universe itself. Well, that's all for the moment on the slides. I wanted to set up this distance scale because at the same time we do the distance scale, we're obviously going backwards in time and we're setting up a time scale. Now, if I can ask you just to turn on the house lights a little bit more, I'd like to check up on the audience to make sure they haven't gone to sleep during this dark period. Okay, thank you very much. There are other quite independent ways to get the ages of some very old things in the universe. What I have here is a fragment of the Allende meteorite, a ton of which fell in northern Mexico in 1969. I have a good feeling that this will be the oldest thing I will ever touch. It's dated at 4.6 billion years. Now, how is that age determined? Well, it contains trace amounts of several radioactive isotopes, such as palladium-107, which very gradually changes into silver. Now, in the early stages of the solar system, certain minerals crystallized out as the meteorite was formed and as it cooled. And once the atoms were locked up in the crystal structures, they couldn't move. But the radioactive palladium would slowly disintegrate at a known rate, increasing the silver 107. So careful analyses of the silver isotope ratios in several different minerals can be interlocked to give the time of crystallization. So according to that analysis, these little white nodules, the so-called chondrules, crystallized out 4.6 billion years ago. And I invite you after the lecture to come up and touch it and be sure if you're going to do that, you put your finger on one of the little white chondrules to make sure you've got back all 4.6 billion years. Now, it's not only possible to determine the age of a specific object like that, but even the elements themselves can be dated. If the atoms were infinitely old, then, for example, uranium and thorium would have long since turned to lead. Their very existence tells us that those atoms were formed at a finite time past. And what astronomers suppose is that there were some supernovae in our neighborhood of the Milky Way that spewed forth in their nuclear ashes a wide variety of elements when they exploded. So all of us are recycled star stuff. The iron in our blood is a typical sample. It was very exciting a couple of years ago, in 1987, 3 years ago, to watch the light fade away in the great southern supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud, because that pattern exactly matched the formation of immense quantities of iron from radioactive nuclei, radioactive decay of the nickel and cobalt in that explosion. So included among the stellar ejecta from earlier supernovae were a variety of radioactive atoms, and from their known rates of decay, nuclear physicists can calculate from their known abundances now the time to those supernovae cataclysms. Now, they don't give a very precise answer because there must have been more than one supernova involved in producing the atoms that make up the scene as we look around this room and us. But what impresses me is that they all give the same general ballpark as the expansion age, that is 10 billion years. I mean, it would be very embarrassing if the age of the atoms came out to be 50 billion years when the universe is only 10 to 20 billion years old. But happily, that hasn't happened. Now, I've described two independent ways for dating very old things, the expansion of the universe and the radioactive isotopes. I'd like to now mention the scientific evidence that the universe had a definite super-dense beginning. Let's run time backwards in our calculations to see what the universe is like as the density increases. The total mass and energy of the universe remain the same, but the temperature rises as the matter density is compressed. And finally, the temperature becomes so high and the mean energy of the components so great that the presently known laws of physics no longer apply. And that's when we're at this split second from squashing the universe into nothingness, 10 to the minus 43rd second. So, let me start at that point and run the clock forward. And I'll briefly describe the action, though in the first few minutes of creation, everything happened much, much faster than I can describe them. For example, in the first microseconds, that's millionths of a second, the high-energy photons vastly outnumbered the particles of matter. There was a continual interchange between matter and photons, between heavy particles of matter and antimatter. Einstein's famous E equals mc squared equation helps describe the situation in which the energy of the photons is changed into the mass of the particles and vice versa. By the end of the first millisecond, the creation of protons and antiprotons was essentially over. The vast majority of them had already been annihilated back into photons. Then, as the universe begins to lose this incredible compression, the average energy of the photons drops, but there's still this interaction between matter and energy. During the first second, electrons and anti-electrons are repeatedly formed and annihilated. Finally, there's left about 100 million photons of light for every atom, and that's a ratio that is still present in the universe. And now, after about a minute, the thermonuclear detonation of the universe is underway. And in this minute, the fusion reactions take place that build up the heavy hydrogen and the helium. And then, after a few minutes, the whole explosive nuclear fireworks are over. There wasn't time to make carbon and iron and uranium, so that all has to come later, a lot of it happening in the middle of supernovae as those stars go through their lifetimes and burn themselves out after their very profligate existences. The headlong expansion continues after that first minute or two. The cosmic egg gradually cools. The leftover radiation, which I've mentioned, is redshifted into the microwave region of the spectrum, but it's ours to observe. It has been observed by looking in every direction in space, and that is, in fact, the fossil evidence of this primeval fireball that came from the Big Bang. That's one piece of evidence supporting our contemporary scientific picture of creation. The other is the observed abundance of helium and deuterium, and that matches quite well the predicted amounts from such a cosmic explosion. This is a very thrilling scenario of all that exists roaring into flame and charging forth into emptiness. And that is what cosmogony is about. In case you hadn't heard that word before, that's a technical word that means the study of beginnings. And that is the scientific picture. And surprisingly, in its essential framework of everything springing forth from a blinding flash, bears a striking resonance with the very succinct words of Genesis 1:3. And God said, "Let there be light." Now, who could have guessed 100 years ago, not to mention 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, that a scientific picture would emerge with electromagnetic radiation as the starting point of creation? According to the NASA astrophysicist Robert Jastrow, agnostic scientists should sit up and take notice and even be a little worried. But let's look a little more carefully at the extent of this convergence. Both the contemporary scientific account and the age-old biblical account assume a beginning. The scientific account concerns only the transformation of everything that now is. And until recently, it hasn't even attempted to go beyond that. To the singularity when there was nothing, and then suddenly the energetic seed for the universe abruptly came into being. Here science has seemed up against a blank wall, and in one memorable passage of his book, God and the Astronomers, Jastrow says, "At this moment it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith and the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries." The band of theologians, of course, has an answer. God did it. He's created the universe by saying, "Let there be light." But for either a self-professed agnostic like Jastrow or for a believer, such an answer is unrevealing and even superficial. For it cloaks our ignorance beneath a name, tells us nothing further about God beyond the concept of an omnipotent creator. Now, not long ago, I happened to be discussing this very point with Freeman Dyson, who's one of the most thoughtful physicists of our day. "It's rather silly," he said, "to think of God's role in creation as just sitting up there on a platform and pushing the switch. Creation is a far broader concept than just the moment of the Big Bang. The very structures of the universe itself, its rules of operation, its continued maintenance, these are the more important aspects of creation. In fact, if we accept that moment of blazing glory as the whole work of the Creator, we're on rather thin ice. Scientific theories are, especially cosmological views, are notoriously subject to change. And cosmologists have taken it as a special challenge to eliminate the singularity of point zero when space and time vanish as the universe becomes infinitely dense. Well, there's recently come on the scene the so-called inflationary universe. I haven't the time to try to explain some of the reasons for supposing that the universe at a very early stage rapidly expanded by billions of billions of billions of times in less than the twinkling of an eye. Now, there's no direct evidence that such an episode ever took place, but such an event would solve several nagging problems that have plagued the Big Bang scenario. Now, the inflationary universe episode, a tiny moment in a much larger picture of an expanding universe, doesn't so much eliminate the singularity of the first instant of creation as to make it scientifically irrelevant. Since the random conditions at the moment of the inflation, when the universe got so much bigger, would conceal what had gone before and would control the subsequent Big Bang rather than the conditions of the universe at some earlier split second. But even that wasn't enough for Stephen Hawking, who, treating time as one of the dimensions of curved space in that opening, curved space-time in that opening sequence, claims to have made a coordinate transformation that simply eliminated the origin. And in his best-selling book, A Brief History of Time, he writes as follows. "The idea that space and time may form a closed surface without boundary also has profound implications for the role of God in the affairs of the universe. With the success of scientific theories in describing events, most people have come to believe that God allows the universe to evolve according to a set of laws and does not intervene to break these laws. However, the laws do not tell us what the universe should have looked like when it started. It would still be up to God to wind up the clockwork and choose how to start it off. So long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator.
But if the universe is really completely self-contained, having no boundary or edge, it would have neither beginning nor end. It would simply be. What place, then, for a creator? Well, from a Christian perspective, the answer to Hawking's question is, as I've indicated before, that God is more than the omnipotence who, in some other space-time dimension, decides when to push the mighty on switch. God is the creator in a much larger sense of the designer and intender of the universe, the powerful creator with a plan and an intention for the existence of the entire universe. So I want to return presently to the idea of design. But first I'd like to point out that both science and the Bible have something to say about the earlier stages of the universe. And in fact, both the scientific and the biblical accounts portray the latent creativity as the universe begins to unfold, beginning with the grand and simple and leading to the immediate and complex. The scientific picture sketches the creation of atoms, of galaxies, of stars, of life, even of mankind. Likewise, Genesis speaks of the sun and moon, of plants and animals, of men and women. But there's a truly fundamental difference in their viewpoints. The great tapestry of science is woven together in a grand and awesome design with the question, who? Sorry, how? I just put it backwards. How can the universe end up with a preponderance of positively charged nuclei? How can fluctuations arise to give birth to galaxies? How can the presence of iron atoms be explained? How can hemoglobin come about? The biblical picture also concerns the universe around us, but it addresses an entirely different question. Not the interconnections of the how, but the motivations and designs of the who. The Bible brilliantly affirms that our universe has come to be not by chance, but by a grand design, and that the designer was Almighty God. In our country today, there's a vocal minority who are confused by the separate roles of the scientific way of building up a worldview and the biblical story of creation. And somehow they feel threatened by an ascendancy of a system of looking at the world that does not explicitly include the designing hand of God in the construction. But I think that science is, by its very nature, godless. It's a mechanistic system contrived to show how things work, and it's unable to say anything about the who, the designer. And I can certainly sympathize if a deeply religious person finds this incomplete and unsatisfying. And I can even sympathize mildly with the frustration of the creationists, who wish that some broader philosophical framework could be placed in biology textbooks. But I think that they're mistaken when they take scientific explanations as such to be anti-God or atheistic. They're wrong when they think that the Genesis account can substitute for the how of scientific explanations. And they err when they think it's a meaningful tack to brand evolution, for example, as a mere hypothesis. Because in a certain sense, all of the theoretical explanations of science, the weft that holds our tapestry together, are hypotheses. And to unthread one section risks destroying the entire fabric. The conflicts of Arkansas and California and Louisiana might well have been avoided if teachers of science spent a little less time on the scientific answers and a little more time on the process of inquiry, because the process is the heart of the matter. But I'm afraid it would be naive to suppose that children might grasp the distinctions that have escaped their elders. Maybe I can make my point clearer with a little digression. Some time back, when I first began to prepare the lecture, I just at that very same time received in the mail this colorful poster which offers a $1,000 cash reward for scientific proof positive that the earth moves. And in the accompanying letter to me, Mr. Elmendorf, the potential donor, wrote that, quote, "As an engineer, I am astounded that the question of the earth's motion is apparently not all settled after all these years. I mean, if we don't know that, what do we know?" Well, this question, of course, goes back to Copernicus and Galileo and to the birth of modern science. Most of the scholars in the generation immediately following Copernicus assumed that his heliocentric system was merely a hypothetical arrangement for explaining the apparent motions in the heavens, but that the earth didn't really move. Galileo was intrigued by the Copernican system, but he was only a timid Copernican until he turned his newly devised telescope to the heavens. And there he found, for instance, a miniature Copernican system in the satellite system of Jupiter. And then he found a succession of other instances where the heliocentric system could very nicely explain the observations. So he began to argue for the reality of a sun-centered arrangement. He was completely unable to prove it in any strict sense. All he could do was make the heliocentric system appear increasingly probable. The Catholic Church objected to Galileo's line of reasoning, pointing out, quite correctly, that just because certain observations were explained nicely by the Copernican system didn't mean that there might not be also some other hypothesis that could equally well explain them. Well, the Catholic Church reacted against this, and let me just show you one way in which they did. And in the final slide, which I've got, you can probably put it on the screen without dimming the lights at all. And this slide will show you a copy of Copernicus's book, De Revolutionibus, which, as you can see, has been censored. Now, chapter 11 was originally entitled On and the Explication of the Threefold Motion of the Earth. I don't think you can see it very well, but the new title has been written in there. It says, On the Hypothesis of the Threefold Motion of the Earth and its Explication. In other words, the inquisitors felt that if they could just make Copernicus's book more clearly hypothetical, everything would be all right. Right above it, there's a very interesting place. Copernicus is describing what the advantages of a heliocentric system are. He says it explains the so-called retrograde motion of the planets, and in this way you can see why this motion is smaller for Jupiter than for Mars, because it's farther away, and it's still smaller for the more distant Saturn, and it is so small you don't see it at all for the stars because they're so far away. And then what it said there under that black censorship mark was, so great, without any question, is the divine handiwork of the Almighty Creator. Apparently Rome felt that this was just giving it too much of a whiff of reality, that people might read that and think that's really how God did it. And they didn't want that to happen. But censoring the book, or trying to make it hypothetical, had, of course, no real effect on the course of history. Meanwhile, and that was the direct reaction to Galileo. But meanwhile, north of the Alps, Johannes Kepler also accepted the physical reality of the Copernican arrangement. And he went to work to show that each planet had an elliptical orbit with the sun at one focus. He couldn't prove the truth of the Earth's motion, but without the assumption of a fixed central sun, his orbital system just didn't make any sense. And then came along Isaac Newton, who with some simple but powerful assumptions concerning the nature of matter and motion and some powerful new mathematics was able to build up a marvelous system of both explanation and prediction. But still, even Newton had no proof of the Earth's motion. What he had was an elaborate picture of how the physical world worked. And it was so thorough and so probable that most people had no difficulty accepting it as truth. Everybody knew that if the earth was really moving, then you should be able to see a tiny displacement of stars as the earth went around the sun. The failure to find it didn't discredit the heliocentric theory. And when, with the discovery of the annual stellar parallax around 1840, when it finally took place, people couldn't get excited about this as a proof because it had long since become commonplace that that was the blueprint of the heavens. Thank you very much for the slide. We can turn it back off and maybe even turn up the house lights a bit more. At the end of the last century, and here I quote from a most perceptive book by Jacob Bronowski, there were physicists who were perfectly willing to say that there was no need to produce another Newton because there was nothing as fundamental as gravitation for another Newton to discover. Since then, he continues, the world has fallen about our ears. Why? Because Einstein's general relativity showed us another way of looking at gravitation. And it brought the scientific community to the realization that there was no way to know when a scientific theory was final and therefore true in some ultimate sense. So science simply doesn't offer scientific proofs positive. And that's why it's quite unlikely that anybody is ever going to collect Mr. Elmendorf's $1,000 for a scientific proof positive that the earth moves. Einstein's work has forcefully awakened us to the provisional nature of our scientific picture. As he himself said about science, the sense experiences are the given subject matter, but the theory that shall interpret them is man-made. It's the result of an extremely laborious process of adaptation, hypothetical, never completely final, always subject to question and doubt. Well, this is why I have continually referred to the scientific worldview as a grand tapestry. It's an interlocked and a coherent picture, a most workable explanation, but it's not ultimate truth. Robinson Jeffers puts it well in another poem when he says, the mathematicians and physics men have their mythology. They work alongside the truth, never touching it. Their equations are false, but things work. Well, I know, just as the Catholic Church knew in Galileo's day, that there can be alternative explanations for certain observations. For example, I accept the Big Bang model as a working hypothesis for the universe, but I know that the evidence that I've cited might have other explanations. But what I'm not willing to accept, and I think this is very important, is some special explanation for one part of it that doesn't fit the rest of the picture. All of science is, in a sense, hypothetical, but the tapestry is of a piece and it can't be shredded easily. And that's why I'm uninterested in the ad hoc and particular claims made here and there by the advocates of creation science. Now, perhaps the ultimate truth is that the world was created only 6,000 years ago. But since the Creator has filled it with wonderful clues pointing back to 10 or 20 billion years, I'm content to do my science by building a coherent picture of a multi-billion-year-old creation, even though that may be only a grand hypothesis, because it is the coherency of the picture and the systematic procedures for building up this picture, but not final truth, that science is all about. Well, I've been describing science as a tapestry with a grand design, and now I'd like to turn the lecture around a bit of a corner and talk just briefly about the idea of a designer. Because I'm personally persuaded that through the eyes of faith, one can see numerous vestiges of the designer's hand in the universe. I also have many good friends who can't see it that way. So I'm rather doubtful that you can argue a skeptic into faith from the evidences of science, even though I personally find some of the circumstances of nature impossible to comprehend in the absence of a supernatural design. Let me first consider just briefly the complex interaction between the Earth's atmosphere and life. From what astronomers have deduced about solar evolution, we believe that the sun was perhaps a quarter less luminous several billion years ago. Now today, if the solar luminosity dropped by 25%, the oceans would freeze solid to the bottom. It would take a substantial increase in the sun's present luminosity just to get them thawed out again. Life couldn't have originated on such a frozen globe, so it seems that the Earth's surface never suffered such frigid conditions. And as it turns out, there's a very good reason for this. The early atmosphere, formed by the outgassing of volcanoes, included large amounts of carbon dioxide and water vapor. And such an atmosphere would have produced a very strong greenhouse effect. Now, after the heat wave of last summer and before, everybody knows about the greenhouse effect, how the light coming in of high temperature from the sun coming through the glass of the greenhouse can go through the glass, heating up the inside, but the infrared radiation coming back off from the plants is blocked by the glass, and it can't get out easily, so the temperature goes up. The same would be true for the Earth's atmosphere, and carbon dioxide, as you know, is a naughty word when it comes to having it in the atmosphere, because if you get too much, you would make something like the atmosphere of the planet Venus, where it's ghastly hot at the surface and no water and no possibility of life. But that didn't happen on the Earth. Yet we started out with a carbon dioxide atmosphere. As the sun's luminosity gradually rose over the ages, the surface temperature of the Earth was going up. And had the atmosphere stayed exactly like that, we would turn out to be another planet Venus. And the Earth's oceans would have boiled away. We would have a hot, lifeless globe. Now, how did our atmosphere change over to oxygen just in the nick of time? Well, apparently the earliest widely successful life form on Earth was called the blue greens. It's a single-celled prokaryote, that is, a cell without a nucleus. And these survive to this day in what are called stromatolites. Find them down on the western edge of Australia, for example. Evidence for them appears in the Precambrian fossil record a few billion years ago. And in the absence of predators, these algae-like organisms covered the oceans of the continental shelves, and they extracted hydrogen from the water, released oxygen into the air, so that the oxygen content of the atmosphere gradually rose. And about a billion years ago, the oxygen content rose much more rapidly, and a whole series of interrelated events took place. Eukaryotic cells, those with nuclei, formed. Since those had their genetic information within the nucleus, it allowed the invention of sex, the more efficient sharing of genetic material, and hence a more rapid adaptation of life forms to these new environments. And more complicated organisms breathing oxygen developed. Oxygen is sheer poison for simple organisms, but not for complicated ones like trilobites or like us. And the excess carbon dioxide was converted into limestone, in part through the structures, shells, and skeletons of these creatures, and it made the atmosphere more transparent in the infrared, and this then prevented a greenhouse effect and prevented the oceans from boiling away. Now, Some critics argue that the oceans is a giant reservoir for dissolving carbon dioxide combined with crustal movements associated with continental drift might have brought about this transformation even in the absence of life. But in the event, it certainly happened in the presence of life, and the perfect timing of this complex configuration has been enough to amaze and bewilder many of my friends who look at this just in purely mechanistic terms. The survival of life on Earth seems such a close shave as to border on the miraculous. Could we not see here the designer's hand at work? Maybe we could rephrase the description of this catenation of events, substituting created for originated and developed. Eukaryotic cells were created, which allowed for the creation of sex, more efficient sharing of genetic material, and so on. Now, the first way I described it to you was the scientific picture, the elaboration of the how. It's the book of Genesis that adds the who and why to that scientific picture. Let me touch on one further example of design. Now, early in this century, after the work of Darwin, which emphasized the fitness of organisms for their various environments, the chemist L.J. Henderson wrote a book called The Fitness of the Environment, which pointed out that the organisms themselves would not exist except for certain properties of matter. And he argued for the uniqueness of carbon as the basis, the chemical basis of life. And everything we've learned since then reinforces his argument. But now we can probe still further and ask how it is that carbon itself arose. And this is, as I hinted earlier, through its synthesis in the nuclear reactions deep inside of evolving stars. Carbon is the fourth most abundant atom in the universe, but it's after hydrogen, helium, and oxygen, but it isn't very abundant. Now, you can make a carbon nucleus by merging together three helium nuclei, and we've got lots of helium because that's the second most abundant thing. But to get three of them smashing into each other at exactly the same time is very rare. Now, it would be a lot easier if you could just stick two helium nuclei together and get beryllium. But beryllium is not a stable element, and it tends to fall apart. But sometimes it sticks just long enough that in the star, a third nucleus of the helium can come whamming in, and then a carbon nucleus could result. Now, normally, something like that would tend to fall apart again. The extra helium atom would knock apart the beryllium. And here's where the details of the internal energy levels of the carbon nucleus become very interesting. In order to get it to stick, you need what is called a resonance. Resonance is something that all of you are familiar with some way or another. Resonance is what happens that makes the music sound on the violin string as you stroke it with the bow. Or perhaps a more homely picture, trying to carry a dishpan full of water across the kitchen floor. And it begins to go back and forth, you know how it is, to slop. And you're very lucky if you get to the other side without half the basin of water on the floor. That's resonance. Now, within the carbon atom, you've got a certain number of these resonances. And in the carbon, it is placed just right that it helps that process along. Now, the details of the oxygen nucleus are equally important, because once you've got three of these stuck together to form a carbon, if you can wham it again with another helium, you can form oxygen. But here, the corresponding level, resonance level in the oxygen nucleus is 0.5% too low for it to stick together easily. Had the resonance level in carbon been 4% lower, there would be essentially no carbon. Had the level in oxygen been 0.5% higher, virtually all of the carbon would be converted into oxygen in the nuclei of the stars, in the cores of the stars. And without that carbon abundance, none of us would be here tonight. I'm told that Fred Hoyle, who together with William Fowler found this remarkable nuclear arrangement, has said that nothing has shaken his atheism as much as this discovery. Occasionally, Fred Hoyle and I have sat down to discuss one thing or another, and I never had enough nerve to say, Sir Fred, did that discovery really shake your atheism? But the answer has come rather clearly, because in the Caltech Alumni magazine, this is what he wrote. Would you not say to yourself, some super-calculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom? Otherwise, the chance of my finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule. Of course you would. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. Indeed, some of these circumstances seem so impressive that those scientists who wish to deny the role of design have had to take into account its ubiquitous signs. And they've even given it a name, the anthropic principle. Briefly stated, they've turned the design argument upside down. Rather than accepting that we're here because of a deliberate supernatural design, they claim that the universe simply must be this way because we're here. Had the universe been otherwise, we couldn't be here to observe ourselves, and that's that. Well, as I said, I'm doubtful that you can convert a skeptic by the argument of design, and the discussions of the anthropic principle seem to prove that point. In any event, Sir Fred and I differ about a lot of things. But on this we agree. The picture of the universe is far more satisfying if we accept the designing hand of a superintelligence. But we don't, I think, from this picture of science, learn very much about the deity, about God, the Creator. I think it's necessary somehow, if we're to learn more, for God to reveal himself in some other way. It seems to me that there is much more revealed to us through the Scriptures. And in particular, I think there's something in Genesis 1 that does not and cannot emerge in this scientific picture of creation. Natural theology can argue for the existence of God, the Creator and Designer, but it falls short in revealing the essential significance of the biblical creation story. Without doubt, the most crucial sentence of the chapter is verse 27, so quintessential that the idea is immediately repeated, lest we miss it. God created man in his own image. In his own image created he him. Male and female created he them. Succinctly put, the stance of the biblical account is that God is not only creator and designer, but that there is within us, male and female, a divine creative spark, a touch of the infinite, consciousness and conscience. It's not so easy to fathom within ourselves those same divine evidences that appear in the external world. As the astronomer Johannes Kepler wrote, "There's nothing I want to find out and long to know with greater urgency than this. Can I find God, whom I can almost grasp with my own hands in looking at the universe, also in myself?" What Kepler longed to know with such urgency in 1620 is even more urgent for our agenda today. As scientists, we have grasped the harmony of creation. We have learned the secrets of the stars, and we have, in a terrifying way, brought those secrets to Earth. As Arthur Eddington wrote so presciently in 1920, quote, "If, indeed, the subatomic energy in the stars is being freely used to maintain their great furnaces, it seems to bring a little nearer to fulfillment our dream of controlling this latent power for the well-being of the human race." And then he added four more chilling words, "or for its suicide." I've spoken tonight of the integrity of the great tapestry of science, how rational man can fill in the details of working out God's incredible design. But for me, the coherency of my own view demands a step further toward accepting something even more incredible and mind-boggling than cosmology or the evolution of intelligent life on Earth. Namely, that God has given us something more, a demonstration of his sacrificial love in the life and death of Jesus. As persons created in the image of God, we are called not to power or personal justice, but to sacrificial love. Now, I confess that this is not the logical conclusion of the line of argument that I have been putting forward to you this evening, based on a scientific view of the universe, because I don't think that you can lead logically to this from science, but I do think rather it is the beginning. It's the point of departure for a way of perceiving both the universe and science. And I think unless we can see the universe in those terms, we're headed with the rest of the fallen human race to nuclear suicide. I can't bring myself to believe that is God's plan for humankind. When the psalmist asked, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" I think it not only reminds us of our place in the immensity of the cosmos, both space and time, but it affirms our place in the universe as intelligent beings created in the image of God. I certainly hope that as sentient moral creatures, we have enough intelligence, enough conscience, and even enough sacrificial love to avoid nuclear confrontation and catastrophe. Concerning these arguments, and in keeping with the image of intelligent, creative, and moral beings, I think I can do no better than to close with a quotation from the 17th century English virtuoso Sir Thomas Browne. "The wisdom of God receives small honor from those vulgar heads that rudely stare about and with a gross rusticity admire his works. Those highly magnify him whose judicious inquiry into his acts and deliberate research into his creatures return the duty of a devout and learned admiration." Thank you.